We launch.
All right.
Welcome back to another edition of Natsukashi. My name is Rob Rector, and what we try to do is we look at films that we have seen at some point in our lives when we were young lads and lasses, and we revisit them after a stretch of time, say 10 years at the minimum, more if possible, and we look at how things might have changed, even though it is the same film, even though it is the same person, essentially, watching it. We try to look at some of the differences that appear over time with these very same elements still involved. So, with that said, tonight I am happy to have with me...
Beau Ransdell, with Last Blog on the Left at frightflix.blogspot.com.
And there is a link up to that on the blog roll on the Natsukashi page, as well as the synopsis that Beau has provided for us for this particular film that we'll be discussing this evening. Beau, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I am excellent. Thank you very much for participating. What's the film tonight you have for us, Beau?
Tonight we are talking about Explorers, and I almost feel bad in reviewing it because I feel like it forced you to watch it again.
Feel no shame, sir, because you know what? I picked up some things this time that I hadn't in the past, and my view is split down the middle. There are some things about it, I think, that I could go either way on, and obviously that has to do with the ending, which, when it first came out, split everyone down the middle. That was the Achilles heel to the film when it first came out. Go ahead and tell us about Explorers and not the Dora kind.
Right. Yeah, unfortunately, no second language in this film. Explorers is really of that 1980s teen adventure stripe where you have your young group of misfits made up of your nerdy, brainy science character. You've got your sort of reluctant, dreamy hero and the tough guy at school thrown together. Thanks to the vision of a young Ethan Hawke, they manage to create a computer board, and the science there is so much fun. But
the Tron-like science involved with that?
Right. It's one of the few times you're ever going to see somebody do that Superman, can you read my mind over a computer board?
Sure,
and
exactly.
It's very funny. It really is such a strange movie because it has elements of so many different genres. Yeah. It's hard to pin down exactly what the movie wants to be, even at the beginning.
Right.
The first hour feels very Goonies-like, and the last act takes this left turn that is part, you know, social parable and part bad interstellar talent show.
Yeah, it does have a little bit of a schizophrenic feel to it. It feels as though this had Spielberg and or Amblin Entertainment somewhere. I mean, just it was oozing Amblin Entertainment on this. As you said, even the poster for this, it's this whimsical, a child's bike propped up against a very Tom Sawyer-esque white picket fence, and then a shot up at the stars. The tagline was something like, you don't need a driver's license to reach space, or something along those lines.
Yeah, it definitely gives you the promise that this is going to be a very revelatory adventure for these kids. And I suppose in a way it is, but there's so much weird technology that happens in this movie with them inventing this space bubble that allows them to travel at faster than light speeds, yeah. Allows them to peep in on the love interest, which I like. I like a little rear window in my Goonies.
Yeah, a little animal house or...
Right. Yeah, you don't know quite how dangerous this character might be.
Exactly, but... because he's in a bubble, so no one can hear him scream or anything else.
So they invent the bubble. They then create a ship that is going to go within the bubble, and they travel to the stars thanks to some messages they receive from an outside source, this alien intelligence that they're looking forward to meeting and learning all about and learning the secrets of the universe from, and it doesn't quite work out that way.
Yeah, the intelligence in that alien intelligence should be in air quotes, I think.
Right. If you can do that over the
Yeah.
intergoogles.
It could take years. What are you talking about? That was the most important thing that ever happened. Couldn't you feel it? That feeling way inside? We were flying.
Come on, Ben, make some sense. We almost didn't come back, but we did come back. Here we are. What do you think? We should trust the dream, right?
Sorry, man. I want to live.
We have our own spaceship.
You first saw this when?
When it released on VHS, I remember not seeing it in the theater because it was the same summer that Goonies had come out. And that was the big movie. So Explorers somehow kind of got lost in the shuffle. And I read somewhere that they marked up the poor box office of this film to the fact that it premiered the same weekend that Live Aid premiered.
Yes.
For all those who didn't forget, this is dedicated to Bob Geldof and Bill Graham and everyone who put this on the whole organization. This is called Don't You Forget About Me.
I just think that's a stretch of an argument.
Aren't they using the same type of argument today? They say that Grand Theft Auto 4 is being released on the same weekend a Ben Stiller movie is, so therefore it tanks.
Right. And they ignore the fact that if it's a bad movie, people tend to stay away from it.
Exactly.
There's a zeitgeist that comes about when you see a trailer for a film and think, you know, there's just no chance of me going to see that. So I think Explorers maybe fell into that category that it just seemed like a knockoff of a movie that had just come out. So when I saw the film on VHS, I didn't recall a lot about it going into this second viewing. And I think it's because you tend to block out a lot of childhood trauma. And I remember the tilt-a-whirl car being turned into a spaceship. I remembered that Ethan Hawke and River Phoenix were in it, and I remembered something about aliens at the end, and that I didn't really go for it at the time. And now I can see what I thought then, and I was completely
You
right.
can see why you put that mental band-aid over the wound.
Yeah. It's frustrating because it's not an awful movie. The first hour of it has a lot of good things about it. It's such a sour ending that it's hard to imagine what they were thinking when they read the script.
It was directed by Joe Dante, who I always felt watching his films like he was almost like a poor man's Steven Spielberg. For all of his credit, and I do enjoy some of his films, it seemed like his mind's eye was always exceeded what was put on the screen.
Yeah, I think maybe his most successful movie was Gremlins, both
Right.
commercially and as a director. It just seems very self-contained, and Spielberg was very much involved with that production, obviously. And then you go back to something like The Howling, which he had also done, which is a great horror film from the 80s and gets mentioned in the same breath as American
Yes.
Werewolf all the time, deservedly so. It's a great movie. And then you look later, and there's just a lot of movies that are almost there, but not quite. So I think you're totally right about that.
Wait a minute, that thing. What was it like?
Well,
It was airtight. I couldn't feel myself speed up or slow down. Do you know what this means? Do you realize what it means?
No.
Trägheit, Schlausigkeit. That's German for no inertia.
No.
Inertia.
If we had something to sit in, all three of us could fly around in this thing. We can look on top of the girls' gym.
I have got a great idea. Oh, no. Ben, no.
What I do love about Joe Dante is that he has an obvious affection for film. He loves film because that's the one thing mm-hmm. that was so rich about this second viewing of Explorers is the mountain of references that are scattered throughout this film to other films. So
absolutely. Yeah, and Looney Tunes in particular. And Dante, of course, directed the Looney Tunes. Was it Back in Action?
That Brendan Fraser magnum opus.
Right. But he directed that. He obviously has this love of the Warner Brothers cartoons and for Chuck Jones, who he's also used.
If we come in peace.
Great, now try how do we get back to our ship?
No, just give him a minute. He's probably just translating in his head. See, if we can communicate, he can give us the answers to anything. He's about to say something.
What's up, Dad?
In cameos in other movies, so... Absolutely. The guy loves movies. Doesn't mean that you can always make a great one just because you love it.
It seemed like it was a nod to his own childhood because... The beginning of the film where the three friends first convene in the basement of River Phoenix's character, Wolfgang, there's a few 50s sci-fi films that are playing in the background, and The Day the Earth Stood Still, I believe, was one of them. I can't even mm-hmm. remember some of the other ones, but they're This Island Earth was another one. It seemed like it could have been a very personal film to him.
All of these are mine. My dad thinks I threw them away.
It's weird. How could get into this stuff?
Oh, but don't you wonder what's out there? I mean, up in the universe? On other planets?
Do you believe everything you see in the movies?
Not everything.
There's nobody out there.
Here it is!
Now, I think maybe a better film about the same thing is Dante's Matinee with John Goodman.
Fantastic.
I think it's about the same... exact thing that Explorers is about, of that the wonders of youth and the desire to learn and the love of film. You mentioned Day the Earth Stood Still and This Island Earth, and George Powell's War of the Worlds popped up very significantly,
right?
Both at the beginning and the end.
Yes.
I just think that Matinee turned out to be the better film about his own childhood, and I think they're both very personal films, and one seemed to be Dante inserting that into the movie with Explorers and doing it very openly in Matinee, which made for a better viewing.
I completely agree. I think that there was a jovality of Matinee, and a large part to the performance of John Goodman that just seemed to permeate through it. Whereas, these three children, as good of an actors as they all were, even at that young age, they were very serious minded.
It could take years. What are you talking about? That was the most important thing that ever happened. Couldn't you feel it? That feeling way inside? We were flying.
Come on, Ben, make some sense. We almost didn't come back, but we did come back. Here we are. What do you think? We should trust the dream, right?
Sorry, man. I want to live.
We have our own spaceship.
When you say they're very good actors, even for their age, I thought Ethan Hawke was really special in it. I think he showed very early on he had the chops. But River Phoenix, I hate to say, didn't blow me away in this, and not like he did in later films. And he certainly was certainly a fine actor later in his life, but... maybe it's the part, maybe it's the role, maybe it's the dialogue he had to chew on with all the pseudo-technical jargon, but it came across as sort of stiff and very stereotypical, and the weird love interest at the end was creepy, I guess.
I do agree with you. I think that Phoenix was probably just a little bit more on the stiff side. And again, there's a lot of things that could be credited to first-time jitters, but he did have a presence. I mean, you could tell that there was a presence, but I was even more impressed by the third character. Jason Presson was the actor's name, and who has since vanished off the face of the earth. I tried to look for some information on him online, and the best I could get was on a message board from somebody saying he was his neighbor and that he's a registered nurse now.
I had assumed he had started a cult, possibly. I'm glad to hear he didn't take that route. You're absolutely right. He really is the character in this movie that I think is the most interesting. And again, the movie seems to be almost allergic to making the right choice.
Yeah.
And there's a moment where he talks about the semi-abusive relationship that may be going on at home, and it's dropped by the end of the movie. It's never really addressed. Yeah. You don't get that Forrest Gump throwing the rocks at the house moment or anything. You just they go to space, he comes back and is still running from dad on the weekends.
And they never even peek inside the house. When they first pull up to his house, it's this ramshackle shanty, essentially, with the typical car on blocks with the engine pulled out of it, so on and so forth. And he looks in there kind of depressed. He looks at the house and kind of shakes his head. The strings play in the background, so you get a sense that this is a house of dread, and something is amiss. Mm-hmm. Something's rotten in Denmark there. You're right. They never really address that, and perhaps they were afraid to. Perhaps it was a little too dark for that. Perhaps there was some studio intervention at some sort.
The old dramatic rule of the gun on the mantle. If you're going to put it on the mantle, it needs to go off in the third act. And there are so many times in this movie where you get that. You don't get the gun going off in the third act. Even some with the character of Wolfgang. Ethan Hawke's character is a little more fully realized. He does get the girl. But the real travesty of this whole third act sort of phenomenon is Dick Miller's character.
Let's talk about that. Who's Dick Miller playing this, and what's his role?
Dick Miller, who, if you're a horror junkie like I'm, is the holy grail of the horror film. If he pops up, you know you're going to get something good out of this guy. And whether it's the old Roger Corman movies, Dante certainly used him a lot. Spielberg loved the guy. And in this film, he plays a character who almost is presented as the Keys character from E.T., this kind of ominous authority figure at first, which becomes a bit of a red herring because then you realize as a child he had been given these cyber dreams that Ethan Hawke's character has and gets to see the kid go into space, which it was his lifelong dream. But that, again, never pays off. You get one moment where he sees the Tilt-A-Whirl car lift into the air. He was the Dreyfus from Close Encounters of Explorers, but you never spend any time with him. The best character in the movie got a couple of scenes.
Therefore, there was no emotional resonance whatsoever. You couldn't connect or feel that this was his Rosebud, which was, actually, I bring that up only because that was actually in the film. Rosebud, Citizen Kane sled, was in the film.
Right. It was on the pile of garbage after it crashes, right? Right. But the look that he gives when he sees the ship take off, and he has the stereotypical line of, you know, that a boy kid or way to go kid, something like that. And the only other thing he ever really says in the movie is this your jacket, kid? So it's...
Which, you didn't find any emotional resonance in that?
Mostly subtext. I wish they had brought that more to the surface. I wish there had been a relationship between the Ethan Hawke character and the Dick Miller character. I think that would have been such a great emotional tie for the audience to get behind. And it's hard to fault a film for something it's not rather than what it is. But if they had done that, this movie would have made the third act almost worthwhile.
And that is a perfect segue. So let's get into that third act, which is the dividing line. It is the continental divide for many a film goer, whether they love and or hate this film. It is based on this third act where they do, spoiler alert, turn the sound down right now, that they do, in fact, talk to and board an alien spacecraft. And they encounter two wayward aliens that spew nothing but random bits of dialogue from 60s sitcoms, 50s and 60s sitcoms, mainly these older pop culture references. And they're more of the wacky Earth Girls Are Easy kind of aliens than they are the dramatic close encounters like ethereal creatures that inhabit this particular spacecraft.
Next to me. What's your name, Zach?
Ben,
where are you from?
Earth.
Anybody here from Earth? Earth, see? You got all the friends here today. Ben, I'd like you to do me a little favor if you would. Would you do that?
Sure.
Ben, I'd like to improve my reception just a little bit. So would you raise my antenna for me? Not that one, Ben. Not that one. Back here.
These?
Yep, that's right. All right, move it a little to the right. And out a little further. Feels good. Better, Ben?
Okay, that's pretty good.
Oh, great. Thank you very much.
Well, get away, son. You bother me.
Excuse me?
Get away, boy. Oh, boy.
Kids all over the world, they only understand one thing.
All around the world, rock and roll is on.
Yeah, it takes a very long time, even once you arrive on the spaceship, to get to these characters. There's a lot of wandering around this industrial environment that goes on for a very long time. By the time you do get to the aliens, it's such an irritating surprise that it's hard to figure out what Dante wanted to do with them. They start off as being kind of goofy and maybe a little dim, possibly. And then it goes from that and makes this weird shift, much like Matinee did, where it becomes almost this nuclear kind of proliferation story. I half expected to Ed Harris to pop up and deliver his apology. And I don't know, as a filmmaker, what he wanted me to take away from that scene.
You're not like the rest of them. You knew we could be friends.
We only got the chance. Look, I know I must look weird to you, but how do you think you look to me? Listen, I watched 4 episodes of Lassie before I figured out why the little hairy kid never spoke. I mean, he rolled over, sure, he did that fine, but I didn't think he deserved a series for that.
See, this isn't real. And we don't really kill people. Well, we do, but not aliens, because we haven't met any.
Robert Picardo does the voice of the aliens. Also, he has a cameo, and you know, I guess he's best known for one of the Star Trek series, the Voyager series. And he's a fine character actor, and he does just fine here too. It's just the dialogue is so weird and it's so goofy that it's hard to see how these kids are even relating to pop culture references that existed
exactly
before they were born and aren't necessarily, they're not relevant to these characters. So, you know, Ethan Hawke's disappointment in the film at seeing these aliens not deliver to him the experience he wanted, maybe that's the first time I truly related to his
right.
character in the movie, where I thought, I know what you mean. I wish these were cool aliens too, Ethan.
Exactly. This was probably one of the pinnacles of his career, for me at least, as an actor, because I think he got stuck in this reality bites rut that he was the brooding, angst-ridden 20-something, then it became the brooding, angst-ridden 30-something, so on and so forth. But here you see this wonderment, you see his wide-eyed, childlike astonishment of things, and his disappointment in things. The one thing I posit is this, is I almost appreciated it a little bit more this go-round, these characters, annoying as they may be, and as they were, when we first see these aliens and their wacky sideshow shtick, it is an initial letdown. But then once we realize that they are merely teenagers or kids themselves, and they're acting up in front mm-hmm. of a group of friends, much like kids will do, they you puff out their chest and see who can jump the highest and who can hang on the monkey bars the longest and so on and so forth. And it's almost like they're overly needy, trying to impress their new friends. And that gave me a little bit more empathy for these aliens this go around when I viewed it from that context. They were just kids trying to relate to other kids.
I can certainly see that. Unfortunately, I can't let you change my mind on that one, Rob. You're absolutely correct that if that's all it had been, I would have kind of been okay with it. But once they start to get heavy, I think that's where it goes from being these two, races of children coming together and seeing that they both have this sense of wonder and this urge to connect with other beings, other children. I'm fine with that until they start to get into the morality of humanity and what it's doing to its planet and war and so forth. It just feels like Dante wants it both ways, that he wants it to be the parable and the allegory, and he wants it to be fun, and it's hard to do both. And that's why I think it doesn't work. I don't think it's totally an awful idea. I just don't think it quite comes off here, unfortunately, because I think it's a great, fun idea. You know, it's E.T. only with three kids, and they go to the E.T. planet.
It does encapsulate many a childhood obsession, dream, vision, what have you. As a young boy who was very similar in age to them, and growing up being weaned on Star Wars films like I was, it perfectly captured in some points my thoughts and feelings and my sense of both wonderment and determination to make it a reality.
There are moments within the film where you do get that spark of magic of what these films were about, why there were so many in the 80s, and I'm kind of surprised that they haven't made more of a resurgence in our times. I think that market is still there for kids. Still want to be kids. They still want to have adventures, and that's one of the things that's really appealing about Explorers, and why, for all its faults, it can be an enjoyable view only because of that, because it does make you want to get out and explore.
Exactly. Much like Dora. So then the final verdict on your repeat viewing.
I think if you look back fondly on this film, you're still going to find things that make you react fondly and nostalgically to it. If you've never seen it, it's going to feel like a mess, especially towards the end. So I think a first-time viewer is going to be a little confused, maybe even a little put off by, again, that strange, strange third act. But there's still good stuff in there, and I think you can kind of see where Dante ended up with Matinee and really kind of exercising those demons of 50s film from him finally.
Well, Bo, I appreciate you suffering for the art, as it were, and revisiting this film, and appreciate your contribution to Natsukashi, and hope we can kind of pick your brain for some more in future episodes.
Oh, absolutely. I really enjoyed it. I even enjoyed watching Explorers for the most part.
Please check out Bo's site, Last Blog on the Left. It's at frightflix.blogspot.com. There are links to it within this particular podcast write-up, as well as on the right-hand column of the page of Natsukashi for wonderfully irreverent and fun look at horror films from both past, present, and possibly future as well.
Yeah, I hope so. And in fact, while I have the opportunity here, and we're talking about my home turf of horror films, you've got to check out a Spanish movie called Wreck if you haven't already. By far the best movie to come out this year. Try to see that before the Americanized remake hits theaters in October. There's actually a link off my review of it to a company called Zavi.co/UK, where you can order a Region 2 disc.
Well, Bo, thank you. Have a good evening, and hopefully I will see you floating toward the stars in a nice tilt-a-whirl bubble.
I feel like I already am. So thanks a lot, Rob.
All right, Bo. You have a good night.
Absolutely. You too.
Take care.
You too, man. Bye-bye.
Bye. All around the world, rock and roll is all. Rock and roll is all it plays.
top cats, but they rock and roll queens. Just a rockin' and a rollin' in the red and blue jeans. All around the world, rock and roll is here to stay. You can hear those jukebox jumpin' all night and all through the day. Ain't never no time for romance, they only wanna dance. The people are hollering to hit the floor. Go, cat, go. All around the world, rock and roll is